Welcome. I'm Kerry Carrington, the creator of the podcast series Remembering Randall, my brother. In this episode, we hear first-hand accounts and stories from former staff and patients of Wollaston Park Mental Hospital. They were originally recorded for the purposes of a museum exhibition called Remembering Goodna, created by Joe Beasley and Mark Fennane. The episode features first-hand accounts from Father Wally, who used to be a regular visitor at Wollaston Park Mental Hospital, and a nurse called Joe, and several very brave patients who will just be known as Joy, Trish and Sue.
Well, I first went to Goodna in 1968, and I went up there to do a course in mental health and pastoral care. And what shocked me about the place at that particular stage was that quite a lot of the staff were recruited from the mines, were ex-miners. And the assistant superintendent, a Dr. Neville Knott, organised and ran the course, and I was quite appalled at some of the things that he was saying, like that some of the staff had severe mental health problems themselves, even more severe than some of the patients that they were caring for. And I saw a little bit of evidence of that during that particular course that I was doing. So that was the first time I went up there.
Some of the staff would come to work drunk. You could smell them when they walked in the door. They were angry. They didn't want to be there, but they had to go there because they'd always been there. I think the staff were more institutionalised than the patients sometimes.
I went into Ward 6 and the patients weren't violent at all. The poor patients, the ones that were violent was the staff. And I went into Ward 6 and I just seen some horrific things in Ward 6. It was a terrible place and the patients were frightened of the staff. They used to cower down when they come near them.
Because I hated being locked up at night, and I was stuck over in Ward 6, which was a security ward, and it was just like being in hell itself. It was...
One white girl hung herself in a cell, so they took her body out and told me to move in and said, "There's ghosts there, they'll haunt you."
There was an old woman, she was about 70. Her name was Ethel. And she slept in a small white room by herself. And every night, without fail, when you went to wake her up in the morning, there would be shit everywhere, all over her, all over the white, flimsy gown that she was dressed in, even in winter when it was -4 degrees. Remembering it's Goodna, you know, it's not Brisbane, it's Goodna. And she would have shit all over the walls, and she would be woken by the registered nurse with a fire hose. She would be sprayed out of bed with a fire hose. And I just can't, you know, I mean, I was 18 or 19 when that happened, those kinds of things. I just never, ever will get those kinds of images out of my head. I went in one morning and I got there, I don't know, 3/4 of an hour early, and I got her out of bed and I took her into a hot bath with bubbles and made her smell better and got all the shit off her. I didn't clean up the room. But you know, I got my tyre slashed for that, as I did get my tyre slashed for other things that I did. You didn't talk about those things to anybody. Not the group of nurses that you were with, certainly not the educators, It was such a closed environment that I wasn't going to talk about those kinds of things to anybody.
There was this girl in Wilson who had been in solitary confinement for 3.5 weeks, and she was one of the ones that got certified and sent up to Osler House. And I knew that she had no family and that nobody would probably visit her, so I decided to go and visit her. So I went up there and sat down with her in a lounge chair and talked with her. And there it was that I saw the other young person who had gone up the year before was still there. And that sort of really shocked me, that this young person who was 13 was still there after 1 year. And I knew some of the other people, you know, who had been put in there, who had committed very, very serious offences, like multiple murders. And anyway, I sat there and I talked to this young woman who was 15, Teresa was her name, and we chatted away, and then this other lady came down and sat next to her and then took a great big bite out of her arm. And nobody seemed to be interested, nobody seemed to care, and I was just appalled by the place.
They sent me to McDonald House, which was like a community preparation unit at the time, but it was a semi-locked ward, because they couldn't keep me in an open ward because I kept trying to run away. So they put me in McDonald House, which was locked, except for if you got category blue, category green, you could go out for walks around the grounds. And I was in McDonald House for some time, and that's male and female ward. And that's where I first met Shannon. She was a little girl, she was 12 when she came to McDonald House. She was autistic. And I'd like to speak for her because I know she can't speak for herself. I saw that girl sexually assaulted at 12 by other patients. I saw her beaten by staff. I saw her hair pulled, dragged down the corridor. I've seen her injected. I've seen her clothes stripped off her. She was autistic. She wasn't mentally ill. She was not violent. The worst thing Shannon would do to annoy the staff is she'd walk from barrier to barrier. Like if that was a wall or a hall, she'd just walk back and forwards, pace back and forwards. And that was the worst thing that Shannon ever did, but she got punished severely for it. Now, before I left in 1988, Shannon had been found twice. From a locked ward, Shannon had been found twice by the police at Ipswich naked. This girl was autistic, like very autistic. She had no idea how to catch a train, a bus, a taxi. She had no way of getting herself to Ipswich, which is a long way from Walsham Park. That's my argument, no? Yet they found her twice wandering the streets naked. Who got her out? It's not like somebody could just walk in there and say, come on, Shannon. They had to have a key. So I'm saying a staff member took that girl out of there. There was also another one who was found in Ipswich naked, and that was a girl called Michelle. She'd been in a car accident. She had calipers on and things like that, so she couldn't even walk to the train station. But neither one of those girls could speak and say who had done it to them.
This is a concentration camp, that's what I thought. Anyway, I was put into Ward 7, which was the admission ward. Anyway, I had to see this doctor who ran the whole show called Barrett, and he said, you know, why do you keep running away from all the places for? I said, because I don't like them, and I don't like you, so don't talk to me. Anyway, he said, I can see we're going to have trouble with you. And I said, I don't like adults of any description. So anyway, I got put into an isolation cell for a few nights. Then I got transferred over to Ward 4, which was the epileptic ward, which I didn't know at the time. I'd never seen anyone have an epileptic fit. It was a terrible place, terrible. And I was sitting out in the veranda. See, the only thing different with Ward 4 than when I eventually ended up in was you could walk around the grounds behind a big high fence, but you could still walk around. Which was good, I thought. Oh, at least I'm about to go for a walk around the grounds, but I didn't know, you know, what I was in for. And they had these canvas chairs with wooden armrest. And they used to tie the patients to them with a sheet and keep them there until meal times. And they weren't allowed to get up and walk around anywhere, and they had to sit there, which, you know, I mean, you see something in your mind as bad as that, I've seen a lot of things up until then, but that really, I said, aren't they allowed to stand up? You shut up. See, that was everything. You shut up. Anyway, I was there for a couple of weeks, and then one day a woman took her epileptic fit right in front of me. She walked out in the veranda, and she took this most awful, bit off half her tongue and lost control of her body function and started kicking the floor. And I really thought she was possessed by the devil, because I'd had that drummed into me as a kid by the nuns. The devil will get you if you're not good. I thought, well, the devils must have her. It was horrific. And I got up and I sang out and I said to the nurse, this woman, can you come and do something? And she said, she'll get over it. Anyway, when she got over it, with no help from them, she was made to clean up all the mess, pick up bits of her tongue and put them all in a bag and clean the mess. And it was horrific. And I thought, I'm out of this place. I thought to myself, and there was no sympathy and I said, can I help her? No. Stay out of it. So I couldn't even help her up. She had to get herself up.
I'd been in Ward 4 for about 6 months, and I'd seen this woman take these peculiar, like, seizures, fits, or whatever they used to call them in those days. And I didn't know what was wrong with her. And one night we were upstairs in the dormitory. It was me and three other girls and a lot of other patients, of course. And she had probably about 4 or 5 seizures, one after the other. And all I knew, I don't know why, but just something told me to turn her on her side. And she just kept fitting and fitting and fitting. And then all of a sudden she just stopped, because I was sort of half cradling her in my arms, and she just stopped breathing and stopped moving, and I didn't know what to do, so I got one of the girls to go and bash on the door, because there was 2 doors. There was one sort of from the dormitory down to go down the stairs, and then there was another one at the bottom of the stairs. And we screamed and screamed and screamed, but they just didn't bother to come upstairs to see what the commotion was. Anyway, she ended up, well, she died. And we picked her up and put her in the bed and covered her up. And they just left her there they didn't rush upstairs in the morning to take a body away. The guys didn't come. I think it was about 8:30, 8:45 before the guys came, and she died at 8 o'clock the night before. And they left her body just laying on the bed, because I thought, at least she's comfortable on the bed. You know, I didn't know what else to do, and I just got 2 other girls helped me put her on the bed, and we just covered her over. And that was really hard, that was, and I still to this day can see her face.
Jason was about 16 when he came to McDonald House, which was, as I've told you before, is a locked ward with criminally insane men and women. Jason was put in the middle of the, what was it like, our lounge room, in front of the TV, on a mattress. He had, I think it was either Huntington's or Parkinson's disease. He was like a vegetable. The only words that Jason could mutter, he'd say my name, like oos, he'd say oos, oos, oos. That was all he could do, and he was all twisted up. Totally defenceless. People pissed on him. They stood on him, they kicked him, abused him, yelled at him. Now this little boy, his body didn't work, but his brain worked. He knew exactly what was going on around him. And I'm going to cry now. I just remember the fear in his face. But Jason's story is very important. The reason Jason was there, I met his mother, was because no nursing home would take him because he was too young. The last time I saw Jason, I used to help Jason. I'd take him to the toilet and he was like my mate, you know? And I'd dress him because he used to get so embarrassed because he'd shit himself and piss himself because he was a vegetable, he couldn't move. And they just leave him laying it. Anyway, and I used to stand Jason up to go, that this is a bit of a funny twist. Okay, Jason being a boy and me being a teenage girl, I'd take him to the toilet instead of giving him a bottle and stuff. So I thought, you know, like a bit of pride, boy, you know. And he loved it. You know, you could tell with his facial expression that he knew, you know. And I'd stand him up and I'd stand behind him and hold his ribs like that, so he could stand up and do a pee. And quite often I got pee on my boots, on my shoes. But I'd stand, so he could stand up and do a piss, you know. I thought it was important for boys to stand up and do a pee, you know. Okay. Jason was laying down, this is towards the end of Jason's time. We're still talking probably 1985, 86. And Jason was laying there, and I feel quite guilty now, but I was sitting about from, I'd say, 6 foot from Jason, who was in the middle of the floor. And he'd gone like that, oos, like this. And for me, I knew that he wanted to go to the toilet. But I was in such a bad mood that day. I just sat there and I ignored him. And it was change of shift. And one of these big male nurses came in. But he wasn't actually, I don't know if he was actually a nurse, but anyway, he was a nurse person. Keys, grey uniform, you know, blue and grey. And he had steel cap boots on. Jason brushed this was one of the ones that used to drink all the time. Jason brushed his leg. Now, Jason wouldn't have had the energy to grab his leg or to anything else except just brush his trouser leg. The nurse turned around and kicked Jason's teeth out of his head. Jason was laying there helpless and the nurse turned around and took a full swing and kicked Jason in the mouth. Jason's teeth spat out the side of his face. Now, I jumped on Jason because the nurse was going to kick him again. And I just kept screaming at him, what have you done? Look what you've done, look what you've done. I think I was in shock or something. I just kept screaming stupid stuff. And they dragged me away and put me in isolation and I got a hiding.
I'm Kerry Carrington and you've been listening to the podcast series Remembering Randall.